Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Enduring Friendship, Sticking Together in an Age of Unfriending by Brian C. Laritz. Foreword by John Mark Comer. Narrated by Brian C. Laritz. To my sons, Quentin, Miles, and Jaden, you're out of our home now, and while I will always be Dad, I hope to also be counted among your friends. Foreword by John Mark Comer. Many years ago, I had the chance to travel to London with a few friends. We were there for a small gathering of pastors from around the world, and the first night we borrowed from the local custom and went to the pub, naturally. At the far end of the table were four older men who had been close friends for almost 40 years. They'd all come to faith together in the early 80s in South Africa and ended up planting churches all over the world. Yet they found a way to stay in relationship as the years passed. They would vacation together, travel to visit each other, call regularly. They had fallen out and reconciled, lived across the street from each other, and lived across the world, officiated each other's kids' weddings, and been at the funerals. They had traveled the way together. I have this very distinct memory of sitting at the other end of the table with my friends, all newer relationships, all of us young and untested. I remember watching the older men laughing, needling each other, making wildly inappropriate jokes for late middle-aged pastors telling story after story from their many years together. And I remember leaning over to my friend Todd and saying, "Someday, I want that." I did not grow up in a culture with any vision or example of long-term, enduring friendship, especially not for men. Friendship, sure, as long as it was seasonal and not too deep, but not enduring friendship. That day lifted the horizon of possibility over my life. Drawing inspiration from that evening in the pub, I and a few others began to gather together a small band of men with the goal of lasting friendship, to walk together, spend time in community, share vulnerably, and go the distance. I've been on this road of friendship for well over a decade. I'm still many years from my finish line, but this band of brothers has carried me farther than I ever hoped. And yet, as Brian Laritz writes, quote, "the older I get, the more difficult friendship seems to be," end quote. There's the one friend who ghosted me. He's cut off all relationship, and no matter how deep I pry, I can't get him to tell me what I've done. I'm left to speculate and live in loss. The friend who slandered me and never apologized. The one who stole from me. It's been said our deepest wounds come from relationship, but so does our deepest healing. In recent years, I've thought about giving up on long-term friendship altogether. Is it worth the pain? Do I keep walking through the valley, trusting that there are more mountains still to come? Or do I follow my primal instinct for self-preservation back into an isolated, individualistic mode of being? Enter my friend Brian's newest book. Brian is painfully honest about the challenge of long-term friendships. Quote, "Soul-level friendship often feels like a full-time job with periods of bad compensation," end quote. Yet you'll listen to this book and come away burning with desire to bear your soul to another in love. The only way I can make sense of this paradox is this. The through line of this book is the gospel of Jesus. Brian rightly teaches us that sin is, quote, "the problem with every relationship," end quote. And, quote, "sin is never just about the individual. It is also deeply relational," end quote. Hence, the only hope we have for enduring friendship is the gospel and grace of God. I walked away from reading Enduring Friendship not only recaptured by the beauty of the gospel, but also deeply moved by the power of grace. Brian is a man who is enthralled by grace, steeped in grace, moved by it. Brian is a newer friend in my life. We've not walked enough road together to have any conflict or simmering tension, but if we continue a shared journey, parentheses, and I very much hope we do, close parentheses, we inevitably will. What then? Then grace. Then we listen, forgive, let go, humble ourselves, take the place of a servant. We endure the only way possible We model our friendship after the one who said, quote, I have called you friends, end quote. Introduction. From I will to I did. When people get married, their bridesmaids and groomsmen stand with them saying, quote, I will, end quote. When people die, their pallbearers who carry them to the grave say, quote, I did, close quote. What a picture of friendship. It makes for a great card, but let's not kid ourselves. It's rare for someone to be carried to their final resting place by the same people who stood with them at their wedding. Corey and I were wed on a July morning several decades ago. We were flanked on either side by men and women so dear that we asked them to stand with us as we exchanged vows, entered into a covenant, and made the most important decision two humans could ever make together. These friends made up our village. I met my best man, Bobby, in Sunday school when we were 5. Moments into class, he dared me to place a tack on another kid's seat. I took him up on it and got in big trouble. A friendship was birthed. Next to him was Jackson, another childhood friend who once visited me from Atlanta when I was in graduate school on the West Coast. I'm not sure if he was attracted by the weather, the ladies, or our friendship, but a few weeks later, Jackson packed up all his things, moved to California, and crashed on my sofa. I met Howard and Dennis in college, where we enjoyed each other's company so much we petitioned to become roommates. I remember late-night battles on the Sega Genesis, road trips up and down the East Coast in deep fits of laughter whenever Dennis showed us his swollen testicle the size of a potato. Parenthesis. After months of urging, he finally went to the doctor, and thankfully, nothing was seriously wrong with him. Close parenthesis. When I moved from Atlanta to Los Angeles, Howard hopped in the car to keep me company on those long stretches of I-20 in Texas where the exits seemed to be 50 miles apart. I met my other groomsmen in Los Angeles. We were in a small group together where we shared intimate secrets and leaned on each other for strength. Not every interaction was somber, though. There was plenty of laughter as well. Derek, on a dare, once took off his prosthetic leg, jumped into the pool, and beat another friend in a race. I smile when I see pictures of our wedding party, but it's not because of the outdated tuxedos and cummerbunds. What brings me joy are the many mountains and valleys we scaled together. But if I can be honest, the odometer on our friendship has long since stalled for all but two of my groomsmen. My relationship with one of my friends has changed so much, I'm not even sure I'd want him to lower me to my final place of rest. Neither time nor taste permits me to get into a detailed post-mortem of what happened between my groomsmen and me. Suffice it to say, there are various reasons for the demise of our friendships, with enough blame to go around. I screamed and cursed at Bobby one time because I thought he cheated on a few holes during a round of golf, which was silly, because we both had picked up the game a few months before and had yet to break 100. It took me a few years to move past my hubris and say I was sorry. Bobby accepted. While we still talk from time to time, it hasn't been the same. Another of my groomsmen got married and soon began abusing his wife. I helped her get to safety before confronting my friend. To this day, he refuses to speak to me. I'm sad but comforted that I did what was right. Derek told me he's no longer a Christian. About a year or two later, he divorced and moved to Africa. As for three of the others, there's not much to tell. We live far apart and have sunken more and more into our own worlds. Over time, the calls and interactions became less until they all but ceased, save for direct messages on social media once every 18 months. Then there's the one that most irritates me. I worked really hard to preserve my friendship with Howard. I'd call and we would have substantive conversations, after which I'd feel full as if I'd eaten just a bite too much of my favorite food. But then it hit me. We never played tennis. Not in the literal sense, rather. I was always the one calling, and Howard never returned my, quote, serve, end quote, by calling me back. While I know I shouldn't play these games, I decided not to call to test my theory. Howard and I went a whole year without speaking until he called me moments after I'd opened Christmas gifts with the kids. We picked up right where we left off, but some months later I realized yet again we weren't playing tennis. Maybe I'm wrong, but I interpreted his lack of initiative as, quote, he's just not that into you, End quote. In the years since our wedding, God has been kind and replaced those friendships with new ones, which have come at the most opportune moments. I don't know how I would have endured 5 tearful years at St. Jude Children's Hospital with my middle son if it weren't for new friends in Memphis, none of whom were around when Corey and I exchanged nuptials. But for the most part, these new relationships have also receded like the tide. I've come to the conclusion that friends are like people who join you with a cup of cold water during stretches of life's marathon. They are there for a few miles to refresh and strengthen you, then drift back into the crowd. Friends are more seasonal than permanent. This is just one of many things I would share with my young self at the altar. The temporal nature of relationships is not a sign of failure, but is instead the natural course of things. While I grieve the passing of my, quote, I wills, end quote, I also give thanks for the stretch of road they ran with me. Their friendship was a real gift. To be clear, this book is not about the people who will come in and out of our lives, but is more focused on what Gordon MacDonald refers to as our, quote, happy few, end quote, the rare ones who will be there for the whole marathon. The pursuit of friendship. My story isn't unique. Our deepest desire is to know and be known. We were made for relationships. In the creation account, God surveys his work and excels in joyous satisfaction, quote, it's good, end quote. Only once does he pronounce, quote, not good, end quote, and that's when Adam is alone. To remedy this, God creates Eve, pairs her with Adam, and instructs them to be in oneness with each other. God's command is far more than sexual. In fact, Adam and Eve's sexual union illustrates the comprehensive harmony of their souls. In the deepest sense, they are called into friendship. To be human is to have an innate need to be in oneness with others. Let's hear this another way. Think of your most frustrating moments in life. More often than not, they are related to some relational breakdown, a dad who walked out on you, a mother who was impossible to please, a person you trusted who took advantage of you, someone you tried to play tennis with who never returned your serve, an individual you could have been friends with until they lied or gossiped about you. I could go on. With enough of these slights over time, we lose our will to fight for friendship. We tell ourselves it's not worth the trouble and settle into the status quo of shallow interactions with others. But another part of us won't stop longing for the trouble. This yin and yang of the human condition is what it means to be created in the image of God. God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit form their own triad of, quote, I will, I did, end quote. This is what theologians call the Trinity. Life, therefore, is most frustrating when we live in isolation and most meaningful when we travel with our tribe of, quote, I will, I did, end quote. Read any study on human satisfaction and you will see the paramount role of relationships with others. And yet, so many of us readily exchange friendship and community for success and achievement, only to conclude there is no amount of success that can satiate our drive for fulfillment or happiness. I know firsthand. Like most, I spent my 20s and 30s on a sojourn up Mount Significance. By 25, I had accrued 2 degrees. In my 30s, I began doctoral studies. Before 40, I had written 3 books. In fact, when my first book was shipped to me weeks before its publication, I pulled my father's first book off my shelf to compare the publishing date so I could know how old he was when he wrote his first book. I sighed in relief over the revelation I was 3 years younger than Pops when my first offering was to be published. Yes, I was that driven, parenthesis, or sick, close parenthesis. Later, I went on to pioneer a rare multi-ethnic megachurch with thousands in membership and launch an organization to help the multi-ethnic church become the new normal in America. The invitations to speak were so vast, it was all I could do to keep up as I flew well over 100,000 miles every year. But each time I scanned my ticket to board another flight and heard the gate agent congratulate me on my elite status with their airline, something felt amiss. I was successful and unhappy all at once. So as 40 loomed, I knew I needed to make significant changes. On my 40th birthday, I sat out on a patio overlooking a golf course, refreshed by the cool breeze and determined to spend the second half of my life scaling a different mountain. I resolved to be more intentional and dedicated to cultivating friendships with those I deemed could be my, quote, I will, I did, end quote. Sure, I had collected beyond my fair share of acquaintances and associates, but I was after more. So I began to think about what a friend should be. While a definition eluded me, a picture of what I was hungry for began to emerge. I was after a happy few who would make a shared treaty with me and I with them. It's been said home is the place where they have to let you in. While it's a reach to say I'm friends with each of my family members, our relationships thrive because we share a mutual, understood responsibility for one another. This is what the Greek philosopher Aristotle meant more than 2,000 years ago when he described the, quote, friendship ladder, end quote. Some friendships are based on utility and pleasure. They are transactional in nature and tend to be very thin and short-lived. Many successful people complain about loneliness and the fatigue of experiencing relationships gone south because others have cozied up to them based on what they bring to the table. Some women sigh at being esteemed solely for their looks. There are also men put off by some women's perceived, quote, gold-digging, end quote, motives, which reduce them to what they produce. These transactional relationships supersede romance. At the highest levels of friendship, what we might call our, quote, I will, I did, end quote, Aristotle describes, quote, perfect friendship, end quote, as a shared commitment to one another's well-being based on an ethic outside either party. Aristotle is referencing a kind of friendship based on a mutual appreciation of values. Unlike utility friendships, which lack depth, this, quote, perfect, end quote, friendship moves beyond a person's performance and instead values them for who they are. Utilitarian friendships are thin and temporal, while value-driven friendships are thick and enduring. I want to not only receive, but also give this kind of friendship. This, quote, perfect friendship, end quote, is seen in many families. When my sibling had to do a hard reset on her life due to an unexpected betrayal and a nasty divorce, I was there to help. My family and I were not going to let her drop out of the marathon, nor were we going to just run a few miles. We were all in. When I have likewise found myself in a pinch, my family has stood by me, even when others took a few steps back. This is what family does, and in a way that goes beyond DNA, this is what friendship is. Not too long ago, my Aunt Hattie died. Hattie was not my father's sister. In fact, we share no genetics. When my father's parents migrated from the South to New Jersey in the early part of the 20th century, they found themselves disoriented as they settled into life in a foreign place, having just escaped the tyranny of Jim Crow. Soon after their arrival, Hattie and her husband embraced them and made sure they had all they needed as they sought to make a life of their own. Weekends, they were over at each other's homes playing cards. Sundays, they were shoulder to shoulder at church. They showed my grandparents the ropes and potential pitfalls in their new environment. When my father or his sisters acted up, Aunt Hattie was there with a word of correction. When my grandmother was tied up with another commitment while my grandfather was at work, Aunt Hattie was there. All along, Aunt Hattie and her family sent the message to my grandparents, quote, you will make it. I am responsible for you, end quote. And when my Nana and Pop-Pop died a half century later, Aunt Hattie was there as they were lowered into the grave. In her own way, she declared, quote, I will, I did, end quote. In the Christian faith, Jesus calls his followers, quote, friends, end quote. Parenthesis, John chapter 15, verses 15 through 17, close parenthesis. This description came days before his crucifixion, when he committed the ultimate act of friendship. His disciples throughout history firmly believe that friendship with Jesus fights against the temporal nature of most relationships and spans beyond the grave into eternity. With his costly sacrifice, Jesus let it be known, quote, I will, I did, end quote. Committed to friendship. Every other year I venture out to Santa Cruz, California to speak at a conference. Not far from where we meet is a forest thick with redwood trees. Redwoods are known to grow to well over 200 feet, even though their shallow roots run no deeper than 5 or 6 feet. These trees can live for hundreds of years, even over 1,000. Redwoods seem to defy the laws of physics given their height and shallow roots. But if you take a closer look, you'll see redwoods are not by themselves. Instead, they grow in thick groves with other redwoods where their roots co-mingle with roots from other trees to form a network of friendship. They may start out as individuals, but over time they grow as one. The key to their longevity is friendship. Any social science study will tell you relationships are key to happiness and well-being. But there's more. Friendship isn't just an elective in the course of life, it's required. In my line of work, I've seen many successful leaders have a moral meltdown and implode. A cursory investigation, more times than not, reveals an isolated person who was incarcerated in solitary confinement by their own success. Solomon, the most successful king to have ever lived, put words to this when out of his vast wisdom he said, quote, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who is alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. Close quote. Parenthesis. The Book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 4, verses 9 through 12, close parenthesis. We would do well to keep in mind that Solomon's words on the necessity of friendship were written toward the end of his life, well after he scaled his own Mount Significance. His accomplishments were unprecedented. Solomon constructed one of the seven wonders of the ancient world and accrued unbelievable amounts of money and women. He denied himself no pleasure. At the same time, he was deeply unfulfilled. A psychiatrist once quipped, if she had to render a diagnosis on Solomon, she wouldn't hesitate to pronounce his depression. I can't help but wonder, where are Solomon's, quote, I will, I dids, close quote. At some point, achievement surpassed friendship for him. Solomon should have learned from his father, King David. Yes, David achieved a lot as he ushered Israel into her golden age. He rushed to battle, enlarged Israel's territory, and brought peace and economic stability to the nation. But David was also a man of great joy. Read his many psalms. He not only sings, but also exhorts us to sing and clap and shout and dance. Yes, dance! His wife once looked at him with contempt as he danced in the streets with all his might. Sure, David had his down moments like all of us. But the image he portrays is hardly one of depression, but its antithesis, joy. We should not miss the link between David's joy and his warrior-like commitment to friendship, most notably with Jonathan. The two met after David's famous defeat of Goliath. There they pledged an oath to each other where they said in their own words, quote, you will make it. I am responsible for you, close quote. Jonathan, the prince of Israel, sacrificed his own position and risked death when his father hurled a spear at him, all for his friendship with David. Over the course of their friendship, they appealed to an ethic outside of themselves as they were strengthened by each other in the Lord. And when Jonathan was slain, David composed a beautiful lament. Their masculine friendship plumbed such rare depths that some scholars throughout the years have even questioned their sexuality. By their example, David and Jonathan reveal the line between sorrow and joy can be spelled with the word friendship. Easier said than done. Our current cultural moment makes rich, life-giving friendships like the one David and Jonathan shared a challenge. We are connected like never before, yet isolated and lonely like never before. MIT professor Shirley Turkle sets forth this point in her book Alone Together. Why we expect more from technology and less from each other. She puts words to what many of us feel. Quote, technology is seductive when what it offers meets our human vulnerabilities. And as it turns out, we are very vulnerable indeed. We are lonely but fearful of intimacy. Digital connections offer the illusion of companionship without the demands of friendship. Our networked life allows us to hide from each other even as we are tethered to each other. We'd rather text than talk. Close quote. Who cannot relate in the digital age to the irony of being overconnected and lonely all at once? Yet Chief Justice John Roberts, speaking at his son's middle school graduation, exhorted the young graduates to see the loneliness of our age as a pathway to friendship. Quote, from time to time in the years to come, I hope you will be treated unfairly so that you will come to know the value of justice. I hope that you will suffer betrayal because that will teach you the importance of loyalty. Sorry to say, but I hope you will be lonely from time to time so that you don't take friends for granted. I hope you'll be ignored so you know the importance of listening to others, and I hope you will have just enough pain to learn compassion. Whether I wish these things or not, they're going to happen, and whether you benefit from them or not will depend on your ability to see the message in your misfortunes. Close quote. Don't get me wrong. I'm hardly advocating for an anti-digital posture that involves getting rid of your smartphones and deleting all your social media apps. The challenge with our cultural moment is the ease with which we create communities where we can block, unfriend, or mute anyone who doesn't agree with us. The result is a utilitarian, thin community, and worse yet, a lack of resiliency toward the inevitable slights and idiosyncrasies that occur along the journey of real, enduring friendship. I was invited recently to speak to a very prominent men's college basketball team. Before I spoke, the coach allowed me to sit in on a practice and take a tour of their state-of-the-art facilities. As the tour was winding down, we walked into the locker room where I was struck by the silence and the sight of every player scrolling on their phones. My mind immediately drifted back to my mediocre high school athlete days when our locker rooms were filled with chatter and interactions with one another. We would laugh, strike each other with wet towels, and crack jokes. No such thing on this day. The juxtaposition could not have been more stark. Outside the locker room, I asked the coach if things were always so quiet. He nodded sadly and confessed that his greatest challenge was no longer finding talent, but creating chemistry, a thick community where the players could translate their understanding of one another into cohesiveness out on the court. You may not be part of a sports team, but you probably know the challenges of friendship. This is why we need coaching on how to give and receive friendship. The Apostle Paul, one of the most successful leaders in world history, provides us with the essentials for substantive, enduring friendships. By examining Paul's wisdom in the book of Philemon, we can learn to have friendships that stand the test of time. Let's listen how we can have friendships that go with us to our graves. Chapter 1, Why Friendships Are So Hard. We would be hard-pressed to find a more misquoted statement in history than the one attributed to the writer G.K. Chesterton. In response to a newspaper's question, quote, what is the problem with the world, end quote, he tersely quipped, quote, I am, end quote. While this story is factually untrue, the point is completely biblical. Human experience, world history, and theology supply ample evidence for this apocryphal tale. But what is even more uncomfortable and seldom discussed is the link between the self and society, as this story suggests that the problem of the individual never remains with the individual, but has an uncanny habit of contaminating those around them. Whatever word we choose for what ails humanity, sin, dysfunction, immorality, issues, we must investigate how it impacts those around us. Until we get a grasp on the contagion of sin, we have no hope of friendship that endures the arc of time. Sin is the decision to act independently of God. Nothing more, nothing less. I'm not sure where you are as it stands regarding God or sin, but if a person does not believe in the two, they are sitting on the defense stand, not God. In the Garden of Eden, God makes one prohibition: to refrain from eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Sometime later, Satan entices Eve to eat. She then turns to her husband, who eats as well. Their decision to act independently of God had
Sample complete. Ready to continue?